Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you and invite all of you to join me for the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit, taking place January the 9th, 7 a.m. at the Governor Calvert House, where I'll be hosting a conversation with the state's most powerful political leaders, Governor Martin O'Malley, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush, about the 2013 Maryland General Assembly session. And it's your chance to ask them the questions about the issues that affect you the most, that you care about the most. Join our live audience, have some breakfast, and ask questions of our elected political officials. More information on how to reserve your spot, call 410-454-0500 or go to hfishman@bizjournals.com, bizjournals.com, to reserve your place and join us in Annapolis for the 10th Annual Annapolis Summit on January the 9th. We are reinstituting something we did a great deal of that was very popular in the years, and so we think it's important to come back to issues and dig into them more deeply than we often do. And we used to call this a philosopher's roundtable, for want of a better term, title for it. We are joined here in studio once again. It's been not that long, actually, since he's been here. The Reverend Brad Braxton. Dr. Braxton is a senior pastor at the Open Church here in Baltimore and the Lois Craddock Perkins Professor of Homiletics at the Perkins School of Theology in Dallas, Texas. Good to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
Brendan Walsh is back in the studio. It's been a while. He's a former seminarian a long time ago who helps run Viva House, a Catholic worker project here in Southwest Baltimore, where he works in the community and is a political activist and more. E.R. Shipp is with us in the studio. Shipp is a journalist in residence here at an associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University, and she won the Pulitzer Prize in 1996. Pleasure to have you on the air.
Thank you.
And in person this time, rather on the phone. It's good to have you here. And LaTanya Valencia is with us. And LaTanya is English professor at the Baltimore City Community College, a poet, a playwright, and ordained reverend of the Kingdom Worship Center in Towson, Maryland, and a graduate of Morgan State.
Yes.
There we go.
Yeah, yeah.
So welcome, all of you. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. The other night, it was last night, don't want to tell a lie in front of all these people of the cloth. I might get into deal trouble. But last night, I wrote to all of our guests saying, you know, that I've been pondering some things. I'm going to get your thoughts out there as well, that we have come, we live in a society that is a society where we've seen Newtown and the murders there, murders across the country in mass ways. But we see 217 people murdered in the streets of Baltimore. We see 500 people dying in the streets of Chicago. We look at the other violence around us, whether it's domestic violence or violence against gay and lesbian people and transgender people in this country that takes place, masses of violence that take place around the world. And so we think of it, are human beings just at essence a violent species? Is that who we are? Is there another part of us that is people of peace? My wife and I just came back from Iceland, and it's a very peaceful nation, very little violence. They have more than one murder, and they think there's a crime wave. It is what people call a homogeneous society. Is that what it takes to have a peaceful society? Homogeneity? And just being of one kind of people? They have no army there, like Costa Rica, one of the few places that actually have no army. And then I thought about places like Sarajevo in Yugoslavia or Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, that were heterogeneous cities but were at peace for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, with Jews, Muslims, Christians living together in Sarajevo, Muslims and Christians intermarrying, and Sunni and Shia Muslims intermarrying in Baghdad, and everyone living together, literally, of all faiths, until the societies fell apart, and then all hell broke loose, and violence occurred. But as a species, are we violent? Is that who we are? Is there another side to us? What makes us that way? How do you organize society so maybe we're a different way? Is that possible? And so these are the kind of things I'm thinking about. And one final thing I'll just throw out, as I had discussed with somebody the other night on the phone, whether we look at places like America, is America more violent than other societies? Is it the basis of certain Western culture that was based out of colonialism and slavery? Does that have something to do with why we are such violent we kind of tend towards violence in this society. So we're going to wrestle with that a little bit with our guests here, who represent different parts of our world. What's this broader question? There's a very thing, huge thing I've just thrown at it. A large net, which gives us lots of room. But who'd like to begin to where this net goes? Brad, will you about to say something? Please do.
I think what's first important to establish is, to your earlier comment about are we inherently violent, that there is a magnificent and messy complexity in human beings. In our operating system, there are elements in us that cause us to go down to our lower selves, and there are elements that are also on our hard drive that enable us to elevate to our higher selves. So in a very real sense, there is some dust in us, and there is some divinity in us. And it just depends on a variety of things that are going on in any moment in a culture as to which part of our operating system will lead. So there's a wonderful, magnificent, messy complexity in human beings.
Ship?
Whoa. Well, between your deep thoughts and your messy complexity, which is coming out of the computer metaphor, I'm thinking, wow, where do I start? I think that we do have a tendency towards our bad side. But it's interesting that the two examples you gave, Baghdad and Sarajevo, when you think about the times when those places thrived as welcoming places for people of different religions and various other aspects of culture, they had strong men in office. They had dictators who somehow forced the society to hold together. And it was at the time that those dictators died or were replaced one way or the other that we started seeing how fragile those connections were, those things were that kept people seemingly at peace. But what we discovered was that there were all these rivalries that went back centuries. So I guess one question I have to throw out there with your deep questions is, do we need some strong arm forcing us to live together? Work together for the common good, even though we might somehow not trust, not like, not want to be with each other.
I'm going to wrestle with that one. That's something people are afraid to talk about a lot.
Oh, yeah.
In the courses. Brendan Walsh.
Well, this is the most violent society in the history of the world. When Rap Brown said that violence is as American as cherry pie, he truly meant it. This country began by committing genocide against Native Americans, went right through till slavery, and we've continued it today with what we do in Iraq, what we do in Afghanistan. We continue to have the death penalty here in Maryland. We still have Guantanamo. We still have over 5,000 nuclear weapons on hand. This is one hell of a violent country. And we settle things with violence. Even if you take Obama's thing with Osama, they could have easily just brought him in and brought him before a court of law. Instead, they just killed him. They teach people in this country you settle things by killing people you don't agree with. And you kill them in many ways. You kill them with the gun. You kill them with words. You kill them with the unequal distribution of wealth. So all of this violence is, it seems to me, it's kind of simple. This is a violent country.
Latanya.
Wow. I think I agree with what he said in terms of, you know, when you look at the violence and what happens and how violence can be divvied in different ways, it's not just the gun, but it's also words, it's also inequality, it's also poverty, it's so many different ways that we can see violence just manifesting. But as we were talking, what I think about when I think about us as human beings, oftentimes, even when my students ask, we are multidimensional. To say just violence or to say just, you know, peaceful, no. It's that idea of choice and what is being presented to you at any given time. what's going to respond, your higher self or your lower self. And when you look at yourself as an individual, I know within me, given the certain circumstances or situation, am I going to respond in a peaceful way or am I going to respond in a violent way? And then we have to look at how is violence propagated and glorified in this country as a means to opt to go that way first.
So, as you understand all the things the four of you have just said, let me just come back to what you said first, and come back around the room here for a moment, Brendan. Are we the most violent nation in history? I mean, when you think of the Holocaust, if you think of
go back to ancient
slavery,
Rome,
you think of the Inquisition,
made crucifixion an art form. So there's.
I mean, I'm talking about this country began in violence, right. by wiping out the Native Americans, and then it continued on through. You know what our position in the world is the number one superpower, American exceptionalism. We are better, and we intend to remain that way. With weapons. And weapons is what puts us in the driver's seat. And in every neighborhood, weapons are the things that settle disputes. I mean, since I've been in Baltimore since 1967, there's been almost 12,000 murders, in this city. If you go to Northern Ireland, when they had a war, only 3,000 people were killed in a war. And this is just in Baltimore City. In the zip code where I am, zip code 23, it's a zip code that does not matter in the city. It doesn't matter whether these people in zip code 23 have housing, have a job, have an income, have medical care, have education. They don't care about certain zip codes. So it's that exclusivity, which is the, you know, probably the meanest word in the language, that some people are more exclusive and better off than others.
So violence, in some ways, to challenge which you're alluding to, Ship, that is something more than guns, something more than just the physical violence. It's a violence of poverty. It's a violence of the way society is structured. It's the violence of who we can become because of what's in front of us all the time.
Yeah, and I suppose it's what you are exposed to from birth to death. Mm-hmm. You see people living very complex lives, but I've had guns pointed at me when I was a college student hitchhiking, so I should have known better, but I didn't. I was a college student. But in my everyday life, I don't see guns and such. I do see people who are responding to having been mistreated in various ways in our society by official society, government. So it's more than guns. It's hard to know how to articulate sometimes so that you can fight against this violence, the propagation of this violence. One of the things that I knew about Baltimore before moving here in August was the HBO series The Wire, mm-hmm. which I love, and I'm actually watching it again on my new iPad. And I'm just amazed at how violent that part of Baltimore, Western Baltimore, I guess it would have been West Baltimore, in those days, how violent that was and how it was just a part of everyday life. But within that culture, there were good people trying to work their way out of that environment in one way or the other. So we got to see living side by side and even in the same household, people who were going in those different directions we're talking about. Some of them learn how to work the system for the greater good. Others stayed there at the bottom, feeding upon those in their neighborhood. I see that writ large when we think about the country, I suppose. We see that we are together. And as you said, or one of you said, you go the good side or the bad side, I guess, you know. We see that. At the larger level of society, but we definitely can see it in our neighborhoods, something I'm fascinated about. How do you transform neighborhoods? How do you get to the people who matter in those neighborhoods so they can help others to overcome this the violence, the actual violence that they are sensing, but also these more hard-to-define ways in which our government and other aspects of society are using tools of violence to hold them back.
Mark, just as we began the conversation talking about the complexity of the human, I think we need an equally complex understanding of violence. I think so often we cannot get to the root causes of violence because we tend to fixate only on the, quote, physical aspects of violence. And here's a place where I think a deeper understanding of spirituality will help us. When I teach spirituality to people, I remind them that the Latin word spiritus, which gives us spirituality, simply means wind or breath. So spirituality is how do you use your breath or your life force? Do you use it to bless people, or do you use your breath, your life force, to curse, to maim, to inflict harm upon people? And as a professor of preaching, so I teach speech for a living, one thing that I know and I tell all of my students, that little childhood proverb, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, is a lie from the pit of hell. Linguistic lacerations sometimes cut deeper than any steel knife can.
That's true.
And I say, as a Christian pastor and theologian, that so many lives have been shattered by what I call homiletic homicide with an unconcealed microphone in congregations.
Amen.
Where clergy have stood up behind the arguably most ostensible symbol of power in religious communities, the microphone, and inflicted wounds upon people's psyche through the callous and malicious use of speech. So we need a broader definition of violence, one that takes into account how we use our life force, even in the spoken word, for example.
Before we open the phones up, please go right ahead, LaTanya.
Sure. With that, wow, that was a mouthful. I'm sitting here looking at him, so I saw that it was a mouthful. Looking at violence from that perspective, you know, this is what I say to people, you know, same thing in my ministry and doing that and ministering in the classroom and outside of the classroom, that words are seeds.
Yes.
And any seed that it's sown in a ground that is ready to receive that seed, it's going to yield a harvest. You know, nature tells us that that's what's going to happen. And if that seed is a negative seed, if that seed is a violent seed, then we know what's going to be the harvest.
Yes.
And when we look at all the things that are happening in this nation, we're looking at harvests. We're looking at the harvest of, like he said, the genocide of the Native Americans or slavery in the country, just this nation that just continues with violence in so many forms, but they're seeds that have been sown, and what we are experiencing is the harvest of those seeds.
So I'm opening the phones here, but I want to kind of wrestle with this question. If this is a very, these kinds of discussions to me are important because we have to begin to wrestle about what kind of world we can create here.
Yes.
That is, and is it even possible to create a world that is different than exists? That kind of pushes the kind of violence that we see around us. I mean, that's, you know, I'd like to wrestle with that. I mean, because I think that's the question sometimes we're all kind of playing with here. But let me go to the phones first. People are calling in at 410-319-8888. And James in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can. James, welcome.
By understanding when it goes, when what y'all talking about, far as violence, I can go back from reading or studying from the Neanderthal, and which I believe started with the Europeans. I ain't trying to be racist or anything about, you know, but I just think that it just, from them conquering and from them just learning about fire, tasting meat, and all this other stuff, it just integrated into our society. And to the people that were more passive as they traveled, evolved, and everything else. Because they say the first concept of thinking was when we started learning how to eat. Well, you know, as far as learning how to cook our food, and it increased our way of thinking. And one more thing I want to say, the Native Americans themselves, a lot of them tribes were just as violent as the ones that invaded them, as far as the Europeans. And thank you.
Well, let's wrestle first with, is this about race? Europeans more violent than other people in the world? White folks more violent than other people in the world?
Well, you said the people in Iceland aren't violent.
They were a Viking culture descended from warriors,
they took a different direction.
They took a different direction.
I don't know. I don't buy into this thing that you can say that a particular race is more violent than others, at least not in our modern society. I can't go back to Neanderthal life, unfortunately.
They were neither white nor black. They were Neanderthal.
Well, they were Neanderthal. But if you really want to get back to it, don't we all come out of Africa? So what is that saying? I mean, I don't know that we can make some grand statement that a particular race is the center of violence.
Kind of essentializing of any social group bears within it at least the germ or the seed of other kinds of violence. So I think that's why this conversation needs to remain, even though we're talking about the national manifestations and even local manifestations, needs to remain at a higher level about what's in the human being. And not particularize it in ways that can so easily become very divisive and very dangerous.
As I've talked about here in the show before, the founding fathers studied the Iroquois nation a lot because of their depth of democracy and 500-year-old democracy among the Iroquois Confederation. Mm-hmm. And Marx and Engels studied, the Engels especially, and others in Europe studied the Iroquois nation to learn about how they were kind of more communal and shared among themselves. So they also had their own ways of private property as well. And I was thinking about what their caller just said, James said, inside the Iroquois nation, they were a very peaceful nation. There wasn't violence within the nation. There wasn't, they didn't even, as one Indian woman explained to me once in a conversation I had with her, I talked to her about that something happened to her in her life, and she was an Apache woman. I said, so did you get hit? Did your parents get angry? Did they spank you or something like that? And she said, no, Apaches never hit their children. And I said, why? She said, because Apaches believe that children are the light of God. You don't hit the light of God. And so, but externally, if there was a war or if you got captured, different story. The duality existed in that sense, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe that duality is in all of us, in every culture.
Yeah, I think that's what you're saying. Yeah, precisely. Said it does indeed exist.
Right. Yes, and the main root of the violence has to do with power, whether it's economic power, cultural power, or whatever power you can conceive of, and we don't teach enough to kids the power of the common good. And everything has to be relegated to the common good, not the 2% or the 1%, but all the people. And violence stems when there's everything is out of whack. There's not an equality of resources shared, and not an understanding of the common good. And that's I think when violence rears its head, whether it's the violence of words or the violence of deeds, and what we're really lacking is a way of showing young people, particularly because as the thing goes on, is the power of nonviolence. I mean, real nonviolence. And not a passive nonviolence, but truly an active one. The whole civil rights movement, the whole anti-war movement in this country, where it's, like that great quote of Daniel Berrigan, when they burned the draft records here in Catonsville, that he said, our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, for the burning of paper rather than children, meaning we're burning draft records because they're nothing but licenses to kill, and that is an act of nonviolence to save life.
We don't really have such great examples in our current culture. The example you've used now are 40 and 50 years old, mm-hmm. right? And so I wonder, what do we point to to our young people now?
Well, the Occupy movement.
Well, yes, but the Occupy movement to me was very limited and in one way relatively elitist within the activist world, I think. It didn't spread to the real street level.
Well, they say in New York.
Beyond Wall Street level.
No, they say in New York with the Sandy hurricane that the best and most organized group was the Occupy movement, taking care of the basic needs of people who suffered, tremendous loss.
That may have been true to some extent, but a lot of those churches were out there doing a lot of work. I know.
Yeah, I know, but church, I think they were organized by the Occupy movement to a large extent.
They were, really.
I was going to say the churches out there. In some cases they may have been, but a lot of the churches were already in the community as activist organs.
Well, so were these people. They didn't come from Wall Street. They all came from neighborhoods. That was, to me, the amazing part of the Occupy movement. It brought a lot of different people together.
We have to take a very brief break and come right back and pick this right up and go back to the phones. Let people are calling in. Let's get to their phone calls as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the University of Maryland Transplant Program. Nearly 2,000 Marylanders are awaiting an organ transplant. The University of Maryland conducts research and performs procedures designed to optimize transplant rates and provide least invasive surgeries for organ donors. More information about the University of Maryland's Transplant Program and becoming an organ donor is available online at umm.edu/transplant. We are here on our Philosopher's Roundtable, but these aren't just philosophers. These are people who are actually involved in the ongoings of life in our community, wrestling this hour with the issue of violence. Are we a violent by nature? Can violence, we're going to wrestle with now, can you develop a culture and a society where violence is not the underlying purveyor of existence? Is it possible, given who we are? LaTanya Valencia is with us. She's an English professor at Baltimore City Community College, a poet, playwright, ordained reverend of the Kingdom Worship Center in Towson, Maryland. Yar Shipwith is with us. She is now journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University and the winner of 1996 Pulitzer Prize. Brendan Walsh is with us, former seminarian who since 1967 has helped operate Viva House, a Catholic worker, activist, soup kitchen, place for the homeless in the west side of Baltimore. Brad Braxton is with us. The Reverend Dr. Braxton is senior pastor at the Open Church in Baltimore and the Lois Craddock Perkins Professor of Homiletics at the Perkins School of Theology in Dallas, Texas. And we're here at 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation. So do we want to pick up where we left off, or should we just go to the phones?
Let's go to the phones.
Yeah. Let's see what they're saying.
Some people called in. I know some of the names have called in a lot in the last few weeks. I'm going to go to some names I don't know, and I will get to you, though, as well. So I know, Leo, you're dying to get in here. We'll get to you here in a second, but I want to kind of get to folks who have not called in for a bit. And Sandra, you're on the air. Sandra, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Yes, I was calling. It was a statement made in reference to race, and I just wanted to respond to that because it has nothing to do with, you know, white or black or Hispanic or Native American. It has to do with us people as a whole being accountable for the choices that we make. And until we, you know, get to a point to confront those issues and concerns that's taking persons to live that lifestyle of not regarding life, feeling as if, you know, that's the ultimate answer, then nothing's going to change. We have to stop saying it's a black or white issue. It's a person. It's a human issue. It's a human concern. And we have to come outside of the church walls and go out into the community and confront those that are doing these acts. It's basically a disregard for life. So when we get to that point of recognizing and stop, you know, blaming a color for the choices that persons make, then we can, you know, start the process of healing and gathering information and dialoguing with those that are doing these actions or these behaviors, where it's like it's total disregard for life. So it's just being accountable for the choices that you make, being responsible for the choices that you make, and addressing those persons that's making those choices, you know. And I can go on and on, you know, and I was listening to one of the brothers, and he was just talking about that seed of violence is planted. So we got to get rid of that seed and give them a new seed. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's talk about that. Let me wrestle a bit with what Sandra just said for a moment. With the four of you, if both love and hate exist in every human being, and violence and peace can exist within every culture and every society, you know, the peaceful Bhutanese culture that has a gross happiness index, not just the gross national product index. They even had, when the Hindus moved into the south, they pushed them in camps and moved them back out of the country. So even the peaceful places that these things can occur, right? So the question is, what kind of – can you create a society where violence is not – and the hierarchical way of living is not the way of life? Is it possible? Or is it just that we have to, no matter what culture we live in, just push against the established norm to make it less than what it really is?
It is possible. Very possible.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's possible.
And we must trade and hope that it is possible. And I think here's where spiritual communities, faith communities, can help us. First, let me say in this regard, I'm very much a student of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who in his book Dignity of Difference makes a profound point that as it relates to some of these larger questions of morality and values, we should not simply be looking to markets or to the government for help. We need faith communities and people of goodwill to enter in to these conversations. So I just wanted to say that first. And second, here's where, for example, words from Jesus are very helpful. Out of his own Jewish spiritual tradition, Jesus talked about loving enemies. And I once preached a sermon entitled, "That's a Love You Have to Think About." What we need is a more robust moral imagination that does the hard work. Loving your enemies does not feel good. It has nothing to do with the emotions. It is a matter of mental dogged determination to bestow goodwill and good moral energy upon everyone, even those who are actively working for your destruction. That kind of ethic requires effort. And that's what is needed. Not rhetoric, but effort that starts from the very moment children come into our world to teach them, you must love, even when it doesn't feel good. And I'll just say one other piece about this that I have been very, very troubled by. And I want to say this very delicately and certainly with the pastor's heart. When we talk about the various manifestations of violence and loving our enemies, I have been very captivated, even as we have grieved with our nation about what happened recently with the school massacre. I've been very grieved by public declarations that consistently omit the shooter, even as we talk about our grief and the loss of life. If we're going to talk about violence, there is a violence of omission that dehumanizes even those who have visited violence upon us. So there have been many commemorations that will toll bells, and I wonder, do we understand the love of God in such a way that says that even though we don't condone violence, the sacred God does not share in our hatreds and in our sense of revenge and retribution?
Can I? Thank you.
Tanya Valencia.
I didn't, you know, during that massacre myself, I kind of stayed silent. As people were speaking about it and sharing their concerns about it and, you know, just, you know, outrage for it. And my girlfriend and I, we have a saying that when things happen, we say, you know, that's still somebody's son. that steals somebody's friend, that steals somebody's brother, and to forget the person who did the crime is to dehumanize him in such a way that, you know, so his father should be ashamed of grieving. His friends should be ashamed of grieving. So people who know him should bury their heads in the sand, and they don't have a right to grieve regardless of what drove him to that. Now, that's a hard saying.
Yes.
When you are faced against a nation of people who are mourning these innocent lives,
Absolutely.
These young innocent lives. So, you know, since he brought it up, I'm just piggyback off on it. Because usually those type of subjects myself, you know, I just kind of stay away from. But when we start looking at it from this bigger picture of the oneness of it all, that same propensity that was in that one person is in all of us. And that grief is not just the grief of the victims, but it's everybody's grief, including, you know, the perpetrator, that he is still a life that was lost for whatever allowed him to choose, as we talk about that lower order and that higher order.
Yes.
So whatever in his life allowed him to choose something so primal to get that type of attention. But when those things happen, this is what I say, as we talk about this race issue as well, it shows us, and I think, so I'm going to go a little deeper here since this is the idea of the show, I think that those things occur and they are allowed to occur by God or in this spiritual, so that we can strip ourselves of race, we can strip ourselves of economics, we can strip ourselves of status. Because when that grief and all that is happening, it's not a black person, it's not a white person, it's not a Jew, it's not a Christian. It's a nation of people grieving some senseless act that happened in humanity. And I think that those things occur. So let me say, maybe in those instances, violence does allow these conversations to take place. And without them, how can we look at ways to diminish it?
Well, violence allows those conversations to take place, but I'm going to bring it down. You guys, the reverends here brought it up a little high. I'm going to bring it down a little bit. I do separate the perpetrator of the violence, in this case in Connecticut, from those others whose lives were taken. So I understand the notion, not so much of dehumanizing him, but ignoring him at the time that you are mourning the loss of the children and their protectors, the teachers and administrators in that school. That's a separate kind of grieving right now. The nation can later on look at what drove the shooter to do what he did and what ways we as a culture failed him, as a nation failed him, and others like him. But that's a whole separate thing. So I will put him in a different category. I won't toll a bell for him if I'm tolling bells. There will be 26, I suppose, and some would say 27, including his mother, who was a victim. But I do separate him. Yes, his family can grieve him. His friends can grieve for him. But that's a separate kind of thing from looking at those who were the direct victims of that instance of violence.
But, you know, in this conversation, too, how come there is in this country never any grieving for the victims of the drone attacks that Obama allows to take place? The drone attack, if you look at it, there's somebody sitting in Colorado who goes to the office kissing his wife and his kids goodbye and then goes and unleashes unmanned drones on people in Pakistan. And what about those children? In addition to this individualized violence, there's a structural violence. Mm-hmm. And this country is the master of structural violence. Nobody else Indeed. Dropped atomic weapons on another culture, another people. Nobody else did the bombing that we did in Dresden. This country has done that. And we've done it in Afghanistan and Iraq to a large degree. And we do it in our own neighborhoods. We allow it to take place. We definitely allow it to take place. Everybody knows where the drug man is in every neighborhood, and we allow it to take place.
And so, I would just say as well that while I certainly understand, I mean, as a pastor who literally and very not upper atmosphere ways, but in down on the ground ways, have spent countless hours with people in cemeteries and in funeral homes and in their living rooms dealing with death and loss and separation. So I come at it very much as a practical person and a practitioner. And I understand the practicality of a certain community or nation grieving and then dealing with the perpetrator of violence. But my difficulty with that separation is that our nation has an enormously short attention span. We are very episodic and we have a lot of amnesia. And so what I wrestle with is that let's omit this for a while, let's exclude this for a while, might be precisely the rhetorical and political move that allows whole communities of people who struggle with mental illness to consistently be forgotten. It's the notion of exclusion. So I understand the practicality. And certainly if you're in that community at that moment, there are certain sensitivities you must have. But those of us who occupy different vantage points as we grieve along with those need to try to deepen the conversation. And I think that was just my concern, is that there's a kind of rhetorical move that's being made here that itself may show or is a manifestation of the very violence that continues to happen.
Then it's the challenge is for those of us who think as you think, and I think many of us around this table probably do, then it's upon us to make sure the conversation continues.
Yes.
And I think we have the means. Increasingly, we're seeing, for example, the use of social media. Anybody can start the conversation, and anyone can trigger some action. We have the tools now. You don't have to have access to big advertising dollars and put up billboards or anything. You can go and blog. And you can, you know, put up your message on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And we can keep that conversation going beyond what's politically correct at the time of a particular incident, such as the shooting in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. So the question I want to come back to, though, is where this kind of took off from. And then I'm going to come back to the phone. Many people are calling. I want to get to some of the comments before we get off the air on this particular subject. Are we pushing a boulder up a hill? Is what we do if you don't want to live in a violent world, kind of keeping it at bay by pushing society always to keep it at bay? Or can you redevelop a culture and way of life where violence, though it may exist, is not the order of the day?
Yeah.
Is not what's in our face all the time. Can that happen?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do we do it, Brendan? How we do it, but what does that mean to you?
The Catholic worker kind of believes that the obligation everybody has is to do the works of mercy and resist the works of war. And both are very, very active things to do, whether it's feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the imprisoned, or whatever. But it also means resisting the government and the culture that gives violence its roots in power. So on the one hand, you do things, and on the other hand, you resist things. If you put those two together, and you actually teach that in the schools from the very early thing, you can get to the common good. And that would be one way of beginning. But it does begin in the person. Each individual has to come to the conclusion that we're all in this together, and the common good is utmost importance, and go from there.
I think in order to create a society like that, you're going to need both individual effort, heroic individual effort, and I'll speak about that in a moment, and you're going to need heroic communal effort. So let me just say something about the individual effort. Mother Teresa has this quotation that constantly energizes and challenges me. She says, kindness has converted more people than zeal, science, or eloquence. What would it look like for us at every level of our society to talk about a kindness quotient, whether we're talking about corporate business leaders here in Baltimore, or we're talking about school children and their teachers, or we're talking about the ways in which clergy deal with one another and with their congregants. Kindness. But I think to diminish this simply to the individual level, is to miss something about the ways in which violence is communally structured, socially structured. So, for example, I just moved here to Baltimore most immediately from Chicago. And we certainly know about the school massacre, but there was another very, very disheartening moment last week when Chicago reached its 500th homicide. So in the third largest city in our country, 500 people were murdered last year. And having lived in Chicago, for example, I say to myself, why is it that certain communities, certain zip codes, seem to have resources that other zip codes do not? And until we deal with the ways in which inequality is structurally set up in our communities, we will never have the kind of society about which you're dreaming, Mark. So it's going to take heroic effort at the individual, but also at the societal level as well.
But we've known that for eons, and we still haven't quite got there yet. So it seems to me that we will keep having this conversation, but we need more of what you were saying. We need a little bit more action there. And we need to find a way to steer young people from the earliest in the right direction, those directions we've determined to be right, of course. But we need to find a way to do that, because we can imagine, you know, our elders having had this very same conversation 100 years ago, 150 years ago. So how do we take it further?
Education.
That's they were my, saying that then.
I know, but I'm saying it's teaching, and it's teaching from that very young age, and even as you and I were talking as we were sitting here, it's also teaching in a way that the generation isn't opposing the lessons that we're trying to teach them, that we're putting the lessons, or we're packaging the lessons in a manner in which they can really digest it, and we can see something that manifests in action, not just in philosophy, not just in a thought, not just in some grandiose idea, but something that really can manifest in something that it's tangible, something that we can touch. Even we're talking about, you know, this, do we teach with the cell phone? Do we teach, you know, we're so opposed of what this generation is exposed to, but we got to turn it on its heels and use it somehow with, you know, with the knowledge that we have, and not be afraid of technology or afraid of whatever, so that we can begin to speak their language. And I think the articulation of it, to be able to articulate it, some things we can't articulate it in a way that can be digested. So teaching, education, and doing it in such a way where it manifests action.
And I think as well, and there's a documentary, some of us may have seen it, just to this notion about what's going on in Chicago, for example, this documentary of the interrupters, groups of people who literally on the ground in very troubled, violence-ridden neighborhoods put themselves even sometimes in harm's way. So again, to answer the practical question, who of us will be willing through courage in our own neighborhoods to say no more of this?
But Ken, let me try to get a call in here. We've neglected our callers. We wanted to have a say here. So the question I think we didn't wrestle with is pushing towards maybe next time is, can any of this happen without structural changes in the world we have, and how do you get to those structural changes? Let's go to Gabriel.
Hi, peace and blessings, everybody.
Welcome.
And to you.
Well, there's been some very wise words, and I just want to share that I'm from Chicago. I recently moved to Baltimore, and this is kind of my individual effort, and hopefully if this goes well, then this could be a jump to a communal effort, because I'm interested in working with you all. But I actually just came from a school where I work full-time, and I teach an after-school program that is called TAME, and it stands for Transformative Arts and Mediation Education. Hmm. And what we do is teach kids martial arts, but we teach them in such a way that they understand that it's not about the fight. It's about the resolution. It's about the prevention. It's about the mediation process. I could share forever about how it affects the kids. But I'm a little nervous, I guess, being on the radio.
It's all right.
So one of our warm-ups that we do, for example, is we start by making sure that the partner is relaxed and breathing. And we work our way from pushing on them, making sure that they're breathing, to eventually crawling and then walking on them. And they're learning through this how to not be offended and how to not be afraid. Because the seed of violence is in the fear. And then that is what is nurtured in these violent neighborhoods, in these violent, non-race-specific, non-country-specific violent happenings. That's what's nurtured. So what I'm attempting to do as my individual effort is, once the seed is planted, really, like you're saying, nurture the seedling, hoping that when it grows up, it'll remember the lesson that I taught it, that I taught him, that I taught her.
Right. Gabriel, I love the story, and before you hang up, I'll let my producer pick up and get your telephone number and email so I can touch you to learn more about what you're doing. Is that okay? Gabriel, still there?
Yes, sir. That would be fantastic.
Okay, cool. Hold on. Don't hang up, and producer will put you on hold and get your information. We only have about 2 minutes left in this particular conversation.
With a name like Gabriel, of course he had to bring a message. That's what Gabriel does. And what a message of hope.
Yes.
What a marvelous message of hope. And the way, Brother Gabriel, I would talk about what you're doing, that's a very powerful act of resistance. It's nonviolent resistance, really, is underneath what I'm hearing you're doing. And that's what we're going to need. We're going to need nonviolent resistance, which, of course, was the beauty, for example, of what Gandhi taught us, what Dr. King taught us. And so I'm really appreciative of that very on-the-ground practical example. So thanks for sending us that message.
And I want to thank this entire – do we have time for more comment? I guess let me just ask a very quick question before we have to go here. And everybody we didn't get to, I know many of you want to get into the political conversation that's coming up next hour, so we'll get you right back into that. But I think what we need to pick up on this conversation is – the question of how we get there. How, as you were talking about earlier, Brendan, about the idea that you have to kind of confront society in a nonviolent way, the way you're describing, to change it, to make it a different world, and the kind of world we can create if we can.
Or just further on the comment about Mother Teresa and kindness, you also need justice. Mm-hmm. Justice, and I think in the psalm, justice and peace shall kiss. And it's only when those things happen. Mm-hmm. In other words, you've got to redistribute the wealth.
That's right.
And the common good. And then that is the kindness, and that is the justice.
This has been a great conversation. I want to thank all four of you for being with us. You just heard Brendan Walsh's voice, who helps run Viva House in Southwest Baltimore, Catholic Worker Center. Before that, the Reverend Brad Braxton, senior pastor of the Open Church here in Baltimore. Also, Lois Craddock Perkins, professor of homiletics at the Perkins School of Theology in Dallas, Texas. E.R. Shipp, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University, who also won the 1996 Pulitzer Prize and is one of the many new journalism teachers here of note at Morgan State University. Good to have her in the studio. And here at the University, LaTanya Valencia, English professor at Baltimore City Community College, and a poet, playwright, and ordained reverend of the Kingdom Worship Center in Towson. Thank you all four for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you all here. And as we go to break, just go to break and I'll do all the other readings when we come back. Stay with us. Don't go away. We're going to talk about the fiscal cliff, gun control, and more coming up in the next hour with a wide range of views. Stay with us.